one of two lectures on gender, and specifically gendered lives. And today is very much about the life of work outside the home, and the way in which gender influences people's lives in the wider world. And then next week's lecture is very much on the way gender influences people's lives at home in colonial America. The most important thing to remember about colonial America is that it's an overwhelmingly agrarian society. This means that agriculture is the most important part of the economy. It's something that something like 85% of people actually do. And certainly early America retains its agrarian quality right the way through the colonial period. We're not talking about nascent industrialisation at all here. Industrialisation is something in America that was in the 19th century, not in the 18th century. Unlike in England, when you're getting the start of industrialisation in the 18th century. But so people spend a lot of time outdoors, in all weathers, working the land. They are farmers. They're also physically tough. You have to be physically tough to be a farmer. It's hard work, something that none of you would know anything about, probably. And colonial America's origins as this agrarian society gives rise in the 19th century, in the post-revolutionary period, to the, well, not so much myth, but sort of concept of the agrarian republic. That's what America should be like. It should be like this. Sorry, save me battery power. Farms, for most of America, are family farms. And so the most important part of the farm is its labour force, and it's nearly always made up from family members. So it's made up of parents and children. There are some hired workers, but often you can't afford to hire people all year round. You hire them seasonally, especially during harvest time. And certainly slavery and slave labour is something that is generally in the South. You don't often get, for example, slaves working in cornfields in Massachusetts or Pennsylvania, for instance. And so there's actually an incentive there to have a wife and children, and lots of children, as potential labourers on your farm, and therefore encourages population growth. Obviously, there's an emphasis on food crops. So corn is very widely grown, especially Indian corn or maize. Other types of food farming are pastoral farming, of course, looking after animals, sheep, pigs, etc. And as you go further south, you get commercial staples like tobacco, indigo, and rice. So food production is nearly exclusively based in the north. Staple production is almost exclusively based in the south. But of course, in the south, they still do grow cotton, corn, and things like that, but just not on the same scale as they do, for example, in Pennsylvania. But that's partly because in Pennsylvania they can't grow rice and indigo. They don't have the climate for it. And because most of the people in colonial America are engaged in agricultural work, they're very much affected by the seasons, therefore by the climate. So in cold weather, in the winter, then outdoor work almost ceases entirely in Massachusetts, Maine, those sorts of parts of the world. It's very, very cold. The ground's frozen. Obviously, there's not much agriculture you can be doing. In the south, you know, frosts are much rarer. The growing year is much longer. And therefore, they grow different types of things. And one way you can measure the impact of seasonality is, for example, the fact that conception rates dip during harvest time, and they rise during the winter months when people have got nothing better to do. But they dip during harvest time in August, September, when people are busy and tired. A tobacco farmer in Virginia growing the noxious weed, here it is, Nicotiana, the tobacco plant. Was a year-round job working in a tobacco farm, You would start planting your seeds in January, and you know, hoe them up in February, and then you start sowing secondary crops such as corn in March. You do some general hoeing and transplantations in sort of mid-spring. You would stop the plants growing in height in June, encourage them to bush out to grow more leaves, because of course the leaves is what you want. Again, keep on hoeing and tending the crop. Harvest it in August, harvest your corn in September, process your tobacco in October, finish sorting out your corn in November, and then finish and clear and burn the fields in December, ready to start again in January. So it is a 12-month operation. And you can get cold winters in Virginia, so you do have to be a bit careful. Obviously, if you went further north, that cycle would be squashed. You know, you might well start selling corn in April and repeat in August, and quite a few months, October, November, December, January, February, there might be minimal work for you to do outside. Here are two images of indigo culture. Indigo, of course, is a dye for dyeing people's clothes. Well, purple. I don't know why everyone wants to wear purple clothes, but it must have been the in thing, the new black. These two pictures are interesting, partly because they depict that all the work is being done by slaves. And indigo is a very interesting crop because it is like a secondary crop to rice, grown in places where you can't grow rice. And the growth of indigo is pioneered by a female plantation owner, a woman called Eliza Lucas Pinckney. She's a very interesting figure. Her letters are, which have survived and are published as copies in the library, are some of the best sources for women's lives in the 18th century South. But indigo culture was something that was widely done in South Carolina. And of course, rice culture. South Carolina is famous, most famous for its rice culture. It's called Carolina Gold. And the top picture, I mean, these pictures are taken obviously in the 19th century. The top picture shows you the cleared rice field before planting, surrounded by ditches and drains to keep the rice field dry when they wanted to keep it dry. But there would also be sluice gates further up where they could flood the entire field. It would remain flooded for quite a long time, and then drain it, and then hoe it, and then flood it again. These are the tending the rice crops as they grow. Certainly some of the rice crops would be hoed, I mean, there'd be standing water. So certainly slaves who worked in rice fields often had things like ailments such as trench foot. Again, you weed the rice to make sure there are no plants competing with it for growth. And this here is in sort of the autumn, the cut rice being bundled up and then transported in order to be sold. And the carving of these landscapes, these plantation landscapes out of the wilderness of South Carolina, it was a job done by slaves, brickmaking work, but immensely profitable for people who owned rice plantations. What you've got in the 18th century is a massive rise in agricultural exports. Tobacco more than doubles. Rice, well, I couldn't even calculate how many times that increases, but from £1.6 million to £76.9 million worth of rice in weight, this is. And just those two crops have a market value of over £1 million. And this is in the 18th century, so these are pretty significant figures. And most of this growth is due to actually more people growing more crops. It's not due to increased agricultural efficiency. It's just more land being brought into cultivation, more rice fields being planted, and growing more and more tobacco. At the same time, you've got a population growth, a very rapid population growth. So in colonial America as a whole, the population in 1650, when it's concentrated just in the Chesapeake and in New England, stood at around 50,000. 50 years later, it's more than quadrupled to 225,000. And it's for the first time you've got around 5,000 blacks. Worth counting the blacks as a separate figure. By the time of the American Revolution, you've got more than 1.5 million whites and 500,000 blacks. And the difference between 5,000 and 500,000 in 75 years in terms of the enslaved population is enormous, fueled by the Atlantic slave trade. But the white population has also increased, six, sevenfold. This is pretty impressive. In the mid-18th century, population is growing around 3% per year, which is three times the rate that it grew in England. And most of that is due to natural population increase. Again, remember there aren't any limitations, natural limitations on population. Usually the population is limited by resources, and it's not in colonial America. And about a third of the population increase is due to immigration, and a lot of that is the slave increase. And the populations, although they've spread out along the East Coast in America, they're still concentrated in the Chesapeake and in New England. Those are the highest densities of populations. Especially the black population is concentrated in the Chesapeake and also in coastal South Carolina. With population growth comes urbanization. English people want to live in cities, that's what they do in England. They live in London, obviously, and Norwich, Nottingham, those sorts of fairly large places. And those sorts of societies are created in America as well. Importantly for America, why America is interesting and different, is that these towns are planned. They do not emerge haphazardly out of, I won't say the wilderness, but they don't just grow organically. Somebody sits down and plans the growth of these types of towns, which makes it distinct. This is urban town planning in its infancy. The cities grow, again, very rapidly. Philadelphia, founded only in the 1680s, less than 100 years later, has a population of 40,000. And a population of 40,000 made Philadelphia the second biggest English-speaking city in the world. Only London is bigger. It's bigger than Dublin. It's bigger than any other British city. New York, 25,000. Boston, 15,000. Charleston, 12,000. These are the only four really substantial settlements. The next one would be Baltimore, but these are big places by the times of the day. Philadelphia especially is pretty impressive. And here is Philadelphia's plan. And as you can see, almost regardless of the topography and the geography, they've decided to build things in squares and grids and rectangles. It's all very neat. So, you've got this river here on the right-hand side, coming in at an angle. But that doesn't matter, you just build your grids around it. You almost ignore the fact that the geography says there's a river there. Now, in England, they would never build a town like that. The roads would, or streets would either cross the river or be parallel to it. Also designed to be a central square, probably for some kind of ceremonial purpose. The most important buildings might be located on that square. And you put the city in between two rivers, which is nicely defensible. This one here is the Delaware River. I can't read this one. So this is the plan of Philadelphia. Does it actually grow like this? Well, this is 1756. You've got a cityscape there. It's pretty impressive. It looks pretty big to me. And the plan still looks like it's being followed. Though the central square has now somewhat disappeared in the actual construction. What about there, wasn't it? But you have got some fine buildings. The steakhouse. And this is a more interesting map. This shows you actually which buildings were built. And you can see for the way the grid is sort of there, and yet quite a lot of the grid away from the river hasn't been built on. It's like a future development, a future plan of Philadelphia. The main bits where people actually want to live is the walls where the shipping comes in, so those are all the merchants are, and the streets just immediately inland from there and spreading out all over. So you develop a sort of pyramid shape on the river, which shows you that you can plan a city, but people will actually occupy where they think the most useful places are, which aren't necessarily in accordance with the town planners. But over time, obviously, as Philadelphia grew, those gaps would be filled in, and Philadelphia would conform to this grid pattern. New York, of course, has challenges which are also geographical. It's built on an island. It's built on a peninsula. This picture of New York, this map of New York, I think from 1700, shows you that they're trying to conform to the grid pattern. Down here, this is the actual city. But of course, they're having to sort of curve it because the topography doesn't really, really work. So there are some allowances made for topography, but you can see how just tiny it is. It's just this little tiny bit here. And then very quickly, you've got into fields, open fields. And this is on the island of Manhattan. Some defensive works here and there. Years later, the city's expanded a bit, but not massively. Still a little bit higgledy-piggledy, but you can see as this bit develops, it's following a much more sharply defined grid pattern, much more regimented bit of town planning going on there. And again, this one in 1776, you can see even more so that the new neighbourhoods are much more regimented. You've got to remember that New York was first laid out by the Dutch in the 1620s and 1630s, so that partly explains why it's not as regimented as it might have been in its earliest phase. And there's what you would call an unusual view of Harlem. I'm not sure what Harlem looked quite like back anymore. But certainly in 1763, that's how it looked. Boston faces an even bigger challenge for its topography, because it is not only stuck out on a peninsula, the peninsula is really wonkily shaped. This looks much more like an English town. But of course Boston settled in 1630, and it's basically following the laws of topography, and it's not really regimented and planned in the way that a lot of its contemporary cities are. Again, 1776. Even by 1776, there's very little that's regimented about that plan. It's still a little bit haphazard. So Boston is one of the unusual ones because it actually isn't that organised. It's still a bit English in its layout. Here's Boston Harbour, and again you see the importance of the wharves coming out from the peninsula. That's where the shipping docks. And Boston is probably the premier port in North America. It's geographically closest to Britain. So Charlestown, sort of a nascent city. You can see very much how it's built on a little bit of dry land here, because you've got it surrounded by these marshes and wetlands, so there's very little development here, even by 1776. Amazing, in that small area you had a population of 4,000, actually. But again, the grid pattern is there, isn't it? Where this red dot is here is the meeting of Meeting Street and Broad Street, and I'll show you a picture of that in a second. Two views of Charleston Harbour. In fact, this bottom one looks very much more like Venice to me. When I first saw it, I was convinced it was Venice, but it's not. It's Charleston. And again, shows you the number of ships that could come into the harbour. Where that little red dot was on the map, this is this junction here. This statue is of Pitt the Elder, erected to commemorate his premiership as a leading friend of American liberties, American rights, one of the few statues of a British figure erected in the colonies, paid for by them. The intersection of these two streets is known as Four Corners of Law, because on one corner you've got St. Michael's Church, God's Law. On this corner here, which you can't see, is the United States Post Office, symbol of like federal law, national law. On this corner, you've got South Carolina Law Courts, so state justice. And on this corner here, you've got the City Council building, city justice. So it's the four corners of law. All those buildings still stand today, though they have moved Pitt. Partly because he had his arms blown off during the Revolutionary War, I think. But he's in some museum now. But he's no longer sort of sits in the middle of the what is now a, you know, obviously a two-lane highway. And this building down the end is the Exchange Building, which is South Carolina's main custom building. And here we are. I think some of you may have seen this picture before, the town of Savannah. Laid out in 1734, laid out on a series of squares, not just one square like Philadelphia was originally, but a series of squares, again with public buildings such as churches, law courts, other government buildings on the squares, and then surrounded by individual householders' plots, each with a little garden behind it. And Savannah was built eventually to have 24 squares, of which 21 still exist, and they're beautiful sort of havens in the city, because they're all planted with massive oak trees, and so they're nearly always in shade, so you can get a bit of shade in squares of Savannah. But still laid out according to its 1730s plan. And there's some interesting research showing how the Savannah plan was helped and governed by contemporary English town planning in London, Londonderry, Edinburgh Newtown, for example, are all dating from this sort of period, and all very, very similar. Savannah again, this is under siege in 1779. So, why is urbanisation important in these cities? It's often the fact they get to live in straight streets. Well, you've got a specialisation of labour. What is the specialisation of labour? Those of you in economics might remember. Basically, instead of somebody doing an entire task from start to finish on their own, it's more efficient to split that task up into its component parts and have people concentrating on doing just those component parts. For instance, if you make chairs, perhaps working on your own, you can make 5 chairs a week. Takes you a day to wait, for each of the working days of the week, it takes you a day to make a chair from start to finish. If you and 2 or 3 other people concentrate, if you concentrate on making the legs, somebody else the back, somebody else the seat, at the end of the week, instead of having 5 chairs each, say 15 chairs, perhaps you've got 20. So specialisation of labour means you can actually increase productivity without actually increasing the number of people actually working. Cities also encourage diversification of labour. Not just agriculture, but lots of other trades. For instance, you get professional people. Cities are often ports. Ports need merchants to import things, sell them on, ship things out. if you're going to be buying and selling things, you're going to have contracts. Contracts might be disputed, therefore you need a lawyer class. They've got critical masses of people for medical care, for example, doctors, dentists, surgeons. And cities are also where newspapers are printed. By the 18th century, most colonies have at least one newspaper. Some have several. Cities also have artisans. And artisans are up to 18% of the population. Artisans are people who are carpenters, bricklayers, blacksmiths, coopers, silversmiths, goldsmiths, gunsmiths. Almost anything that you could think of they were doing it in colonial America. You also get lots and lots of small shops, shopkeepers, people selling the stuff that's imported, selling clothes, china, furniture, sweets, food. So, in this sense, they're not very different from any kind of market town in England. Towns also give you some opportunities for female employment. Most of the time, women aren't permitted or encouraged or allowed to be in business on their own. But sometimes, they were permitted to take over a business when they were widowed. A famous example there is Elizabeth Timothy, whose husband, Peter Timothy, was the editor of the South Carolina Gazette. And when he died, she edited that newspaper for a number of years until her son was old enough to take over. And women are also working as midwives. Again, you've got a critical mass of population. Seamstresses, a common female occupation. But they owned a surprisingly large number of taverns, and other types of hospitality industries. And of course, they worked as prostitutes. Any time you get a port, is where you get concentrations of prostitutes, because you've got a ready clientele in sailors. And then some just fairly random pictures of what you might be able to do in a colonial town. You remember famously Benjamin Franklin started out as a printer and for a long time edited the Pennsylvania Gazette. This is an example of the sort of furniture that's being made by very highly skilled craftsmen in America. A dresser, very expensive piece of furniture, custom made, no doubt built to order, but would compete with the finest imported stuff from England, especially in the 1760s and 1770s when there are political issues about whether you buy stuff from England. So that, in a way, encourages colonial artisans. So you've got very much a male-dominated world of work, with some opportunities for female employment, but not massive ones. It's men who are, agricultural, but they're also doing a lot of the work in terms of in cities as well. But what you do get in colonial America is, as you would in any society, disparity between the richest and the poorest. And some of the richest and some of the poorest are often found in towns. For example, in Boston, between 1687 and 1770, the richest segment of the population increased their share of the total wealth of the city by 16%. In South Carolina, the same thing sort of happened. And in fact, 9 of the 10 richest people in colonial America in 1770 were from South Carolina, who made their money on rice, on the backs of slaves. And generally what you get in colonial America is the proportion of wealth owned by the poorest segment of the population is falling. So urbanization, to some extent, exacerbates wealth inequality. Which doesn't, of course, mean you don't have any poor people in rural areas. You do, but there's never quite as many. Who are the poor? Well, poor are not necessarily people who are economically poor, it's people who are unable to support themselves. And by unable, you have to be sick, long-term sick, chronically sick, disabled perhaps, insane, blind, deaf. You have to be old. And by old, I mean really old by colonial American standards. I mean, in colonial America, if you were 50, you're pretty old. Whereas to be a pauper, you need to be like 80, which is like being 100 now. Orphan children, they're generally considered the poor, you know, the poor. But sometimes orphan children have money or estates from their parents. They just, you know, need somebody to look after them. The infirm. So it's not people who just can't find work. Those people are the poor. I mean, they are poor, but they're not the poor. They don't count. They don't classify as being poor. And this definition of who the poor are is what you get in England. So they're just imported that definition from England. Poor people, those unable to support themselves, could find help from local government, which in many states, or many colonies, is the county court, but in some southern states, it's the Anglican parish vestry. In Virginia, in the Carolinas, in Georgia, it's the Anglican parishes that distribute poor relief, just as they do in England. And this is money that they earn, they raise through local taxation. So they usually levy some kind of rate on the local people and spend it on poor relief. But you have to apply for poor relief. There's no system of people going out there and finding the poor and giving them assistance. That's not how it works. You have to come looking for it. You have to come begging for it. The only way you're going to get any help is by painting such a miserable picture of your life that no one could possibly refuse you. How do they assess whether you're worthy or not? Well, they look at your background. Have you been of good character? Have you had illegitimate children? That's not a very good thing. Have you got a reputation as being a drunk? Have you looked after your children? Have you done all your duties through life? Are you poor through misfortune? Through no fault of your own, through circumstance, and not through willful neglect, through idleness. If you meet all those types of criteria, then you could get relief. You could get help. And help is not a check, not always cash. Sometimes it would be cash. More often it's goods. It's goods in kind. Or it's a promise to pay bills. But you go and get what you need, and get them to send us the bill, and we'll pay for your groceries or whatever. Or we'll pay your rent. And sometimes you pay third parties to care for someone. Like you contract as a vestry with John Smith to look after Mary Jones because she's blind or elderly. And you pay him to provide all of her necessaries. And this all happens very often in rural areas. Though, of course, you shouldn't underestimate the amount of poverty that is ignored by the poor relief system. For example, people who can't find work, they find it difficult. And a lot of people are too proud to go and ask for poor relief, and their family would support them more. They take them in. Urban poverty, as the cities grow, as Philadelphia, Boston, New York grow in the 18th century, then they attract lots of migrants, and the migrants are often the people who get sick when they arrive, they get diseases, they're exhausted, they're tired, they've probably spent every penny they have just getting to America. They haven't got a job. These are the people who are the poorest. And often there are rules, residency rules, settlement rules, which say that you can't be helped if you're a new arrival. You have to live somewhere for a year before you get assistance. So, as a response, you get some private charitable organisations to help immigration, help newly arrived immigrants. For example, the German Friendly Society in Charleston, founded in 1766. The German Friendly Society is expressly organised to help immigrants. get them somewhere to stay, a job perhaps. And a lot of those are organised ethnically, St Andrew's Societies, St George's Societies, Huguenot Clubs, and these are all to help immigrants assimilate and make the transition into American society. But the rising numbers of poor people who do qualify for help, which, you know, these numbers are rising in every American city, cities respond by creating institutions which house these people. The first poorhouse in America opens in Boston in 1685, and it's followed in the 18th century by New York in 1736, Charleston in 1738, Philadelphia in 1751, and Baltimore in 1773. Why create poor houses? Well, the fear that the out-relief system, giving paupers money or goods, is an open invitation to abuse. You know, a pauper who's receiving out-relief can stay in their own home, for instance. So maybe there's not enough disincentive to claim. By saying you have to go live in a poorhouse, you lose your own home, you lose any kind of neighbourhood, family, friends, connection, you're shut away. So, the idea is that you can control the poor better, you can control what influences they get access to. You know, limit the amount of business they have, prevent them having access to alcohol. But also, it's a method of cutting costs for the poorhouses. They can cut costs and save money. Poorhouses only exist in these big cities in the 18th century. They spread a bit more to rural areas in the 19th century, but they're never absolutely everywhere. And certainly the poor law regulations are enforced more strictly some northern cities, for example, Boston and Philadelphia, than they are further south, for example, in Charleston. There tends to be a bit of a north-south divide there going on. Partly the reason for that, I think, is financial, in that people in South Carolina have more money, they pay more taxes, but they have so much money they don't even really notice the amount of taxes they're paying. So, poorly, we tend to be a little bit more generous than it does further north. And as you can see from these two pictures, the old Baltimore Arms House in 1733, and this one in Philadelphia, built in 1751. These aren't small, rickety old buildings. They are statements of municipal magnificence. As in, we live in such a wonderful society, we're so benevolent, and we look after our people so well, that even the poor are housed in structures like this. Huge, big mansions. Life in those institutions is pretty grim, but the buildings from the outside look very impressive. So it's a sort of statement of civic pride. On the other end of the scale, this is Bethesda, George Whitfield's orphanage in Georgia. Remember Whitfield from last week? The big house, surrounded by the dormitories for the orphans. Whitfield caused a huge stink in Georgia because he took it upon himself to rescue all indigent children in Georgia, which meant he went around and sort of took children away from their families and said, your child's really poor and in need of my care, I'm going to take him now. You know, understandably, people were slightly annoyed by that sort of attitude. Periodically when he went off on his preaching tours, these families would turn up at Bethesda and take their children away again, since it was rather high-handed. Bethesda, though, was seen as a bit of a model. The original orphan house burned down in 1773, and about 80 years later, the land was sold to another charitable society, the Union Society, in Savannah, and another orphanage was built on the same spot and still in existence today. And it's still called Bethesda. So, things to learn today. early America is becoming more diverse. It's moving away from its, like, basically you grow your own food and you eat it type economy. So it's being a bit more like it is in England, a bit more diversified. People do work a lot. Most people who are working, of course, are men. They're working long hours. They're working for their families. If they're not working outside in the cold, then they're working in shops, making things, or after the craft workshops. Obviously, there are poor people and rich people all through America. It's not the land of milk and honey and the land of plenty that you might imagine. But poverty, and as a social problem, is only really significant in the cities. Outside of the cities, it's a very, very manageable problem. There's only ever two or three paupers on the poor rolls at any one time. Right, so next week I'm going to talk about domesticity and how, if the world of work is the world of men, how the domestic sphere is really the world of women.